Our goal this evening is going to be David and Bathsheba, the part two. So what we did last week is we learned through the text of Perek Yud Aleph, and now we're going to be doing Perek Yud Bay. So with the building blocks of the two parakim, which are the essential story, we'll have the ability to analyze it more holistically. So again, the idea tonight is less bigger questions and more just the building blocks to get the structure in order. So let's start at the very beginning. This is a very emotional perek as well, in its own way. It's a roller coaster of emotion on many sides. So we're going to focus on a few things. So what happens is David HaMelech has, at this point in time, married Bathsheba. Her previous husband, is no longer. He tragically died in battle, and David HaMelech is now married Bathsheba. That's what we have up till this point. So now, what happens afterwards? What exactly follows up? Complicated. So this is Perek Yud Beis. Not so simple. So let's try to absorb this. Just reading the Perek by itself is so powerful, just by itself, without even doing anything else, any other mevarshim. The Perek is such a powerful experience. This is going to be one of the first times, and there's a few, that David HaMelech has in his life, where somebody tries to explain something to him, not in a direct manner, tries to give David HaMelech a roundabout explanation of things. So here we have it. Let's look at what we're going to focus on is the first six psukim, Aleph to Vav, and here we go. Vayishlach Hashem es Nasan el David. Hashem sends Natan, the prophets, to David. Where's Shmuel? Shmuel's no longer. He's no longer alive. So that's why in his place, in his stead, we have another prophet now, Nasan Hanavi. There are two people who live in the same city. One is rich and one is poor. The rich person had many flocks to his name, but a rosh ain kol. And the poor one has nothing. Ki im kivsa achas ketana asher kana. He only has one lamb which he bought. And he sustains it. Vatigdal imoiv im bonoviachtov, and he brings it up almost as a family member. Mipitoi toichal mikosoi tishte. It eats from his plate and it drinks from his cup. Uvechekoi tishkov ayiloi kavas, and he sleeps with it. So it means to say, it's like you can imagine, it's one shack, one little shack, and there's probably a one room shack in the field. And and everybody sort of huddles together in the one little straw mat that they have to live. Actually, we went out to Pennsylvania a few years ago, and they had this old farm, a Dutch farm there, and they showed how the beds used to operate in those days. So because it was so cold, they would have, like, you know, the parents would sleep on the top, and the kids would sleep underneath, and they would have these coals, you know, with the straw and everything, which would go underneath, and they'd have a covering for the whole bed. So basically, the entire family is kept in one canopy, because just to retain heat, it was so cold in those nights. So you can imagine, right? So this is the farm, right? The whole household's in one little straw mat with a, you know, and this is the lamb is part of the family. And somebody comes over to the rich man. So he has a guest, but he feels badly. He doesn't want to give from his own flock to this guest. So he takes the only possession of the poor person, which is his lamb, and he gives it as food for his own guest. And David immediately, upon hearing this, gets furious upon hearing the story. He makes a oath. Whoever could be so atrocious, whoever could be so insensitive, is deserving of death. And he has to pay four times over for the lamb. Because he did this and he just didn't have chemla. How do you translate the word chemla for a moment, yeah?
Compassion.
Compassion, right. So compassion, grace maybe, for this person. So obviously we as the reader have a little more of an idea what's going on over here. But David HaMelech clearly is not aware of this as it's happening, and this is a very powerful moment. David HaMelech, obviously as a king, adjudicates many, many cases. And we're going to see some, we've seen some, and we'll see Shlomo HaMelech will have many. So this is not unusual that he'll be presented a legal case between neighbors. So he already jumps to the conclusion. To make it more real, just for a moment, before even dealing with the details, I came across a section in Rav Soloveitchik's speech from 1956, which was given in the Lamport Auditorium in Yeshiva University, later transcribed into a leaflet or a booklet called Kol Dodi Dofek, called The Knock of My Beloved, which is a book which talks about the Holocaust and the reconstitution 8 years earlier of the State of Israel. And in it, listen to this, he gives a sort of a vision of this mashal, of this parable, in the terms of 1956. Remember, 1956 at this point in time, Israel barely has an economy, and they're clearly not out of the woods. And Egypt is developing chemical warheads to attack Israel during the 1950s. There's the attrition in the Sinai Peninsula. Israel's desperately looking for arms. Nobody's willing to sell arms to Israel. This is the period. It's a very precarious time for the state of Israel. And you listen to this paragraph in Rav Soloveitchik's work. He's referring to our mashal, just to give it real grounding. We too, in Source 14, in the Mefarshim packet, says, we too are living in troubled times, in days of anger and distress. We have been afflicted with violent pogroms and have become accustomed to suffering. In the past 15 years, 1941 to 56, we have undergone torturous ordeals that are unparalleled in thousands of years of diaspora, degradation, and destruction. This chapter of suffering did not end with the establishment of the State of Israel. To this day, the state is still in a condition of crisis and danger, and we all fear for its future. We are all eyewitness to the rising star of the iniquitous and to the corruption of international law by the Western nations out of indifference to the principles of justice and fairness. All try to curry favor with our enemies and bow and scrape before them with false humility and shameful hypocrisy. All are concerned with the welfare of our enemies and remain indifferent to the suffering of the Jewish state, much like the rich man who stole the lamb of the poor, powerless, uninfluential neighbor. Isn't that just a fascinating description of this? So like so this transposition in the history of things. And we see it today to a certain degree, but in a shift, because unlike in the 1950s, Israel today is powerful. And it's funny because part of the fact that Israel is a powerful military force is the reason why the very liberal sides of the world doesn't support it, because the liberal world will always, the extreme liberal will always support the underdog. But it's funny that even when Israel was the underdog, they still didn't support Israel. France was the only ally at this point who closed their arms embargo in 1967 before the war. Right? So his point is that, you know, where are our friends? We're this sort of isolated, poor, alone nation, and everybody else is trying to bend over backwards to the powers of oil or the powers, whatever other dynamics there are in the Middle East. Just a very, very powerful way of thinking about it. Sometimes it's funny to be on the outside, but it's interesting to be on the inside. It's interesting to be that individual. Just a very fascinating, this is not related to the actual Parashanut, but it's just a very powerful message that I thought was interesting. Now, back to the Parashanut itself. There's a lot of questions that could be asked about this. I'd like to just put out a few we'll call it actually linguistic issues that are worth noting. Number one is the word for a poor person in Hebrew is usually the word ani, right? But it can also be, another word in Hebrew is dal, and the is rash, right? So there's a few words that can be used for poor people. Rash, as a poor person, is spelt resh shin. Resh shin. Two letters. If you take a look in this version of the description of the poor person, look how it's spelt. It's resh aleph shin, which also means the word head, right, ahead. So although it's funny because that's almost a diametric opposite meaning to the rush, to the poor person, just looking at the words. And all of them, unfortunately, say, yes, it means rush, it means a poor person. It just is interesting that the text is almost giving us a opposite meaning to the meaning it is itself. Here you have the poor person who's ultimately the head. If we're going to obviously fast forward to the nimshal, to the application of this, who is the poor person is? Yes, but then it flips back to Aleph at the end, right? So it's interesting that there seems to be this oscillation of who this Rush is. And I wonder, I haven't seen anybody talk about this, but I just percolating this idea for a little bit, was wondering if, you know, obviously the person represented by the poor person is Uriah, right? Uriah has one wife, so to speak, and David HaMelech has power, and he has many relationships, and he has, right, that's the sort of the general format over here. So what the Tanakh may be questioning is, who is the Rush and who is the Rosh? You know, like when we look back to the previous parak, and you have an individual who's not willing to go to his own house because the Aaron and the soldiers are in the field, and that kind of nobility, even though he was dismissing the king's orders, but at the same time, one asks, who is the Rush, who is the Rosh? So it might be Tanakh sort of underscoring the dramatic irony of who really is the leader here to a certain degree in these actions. Just a food for thought. More than that, let's focus on that word chemla for a second. Okay, so the word chemla is the word that you used here. It's used twice in this paragraph. Let's contextualize that word. So the first time it's used is, what happens? You have this rich person, and he has a guest. And what is he worried about? He doesn't want vayachmol. He has compassion, so to speak, on his own poor flocks. Is that compassion? No, that's misguided. That's a misguided emotion. He's going to explain to everybody else that he had compassion, but that's misguided compassion, right? To sacrifice others. I remember, and I have to apologize for this quotation, but it's been many years ago. When this is just such a fabulous quotation, that when the first Shrek movie came out a long while ago, and I have to apologize. It's so beneath learning in Tanakh. But there's a wonderful quotation where the king gets up in front of his men and he talks about going to save a damsel, a princess in distress, and he gives them the preparation speech, and he says, "Men, this is a dangerous mission. Many of you may die, but that is a risk I am willing to take." And there's so much of that. So many times we take, you know, we take risks on other people's behalves, and vayachmol, and he has compassion for the sake of somebody else's sheep. There's something very wrong with that use of it.
That's basically what David did.
And that's what David did. But let's go for the next usage of it. Let's look at the end of the paragraph. How's it used then? Why is David HaMelech get angry? Vayasher loy chamal, because he didn't have compassion. Meaning the real compassion on the poor man in his lab, right? That's the way it is. Meaning to say, this person had the misguided passion. David HaMelech is angry they didn't have the real compassion. Fascinating. But before we come into one last interesting thing, a thought over here. And that is that, in fact, the word chemla appears in Tanakh as one of the keywords relating to what sin?
Shaul
sin. Isn't interesting. Take a quick look at this. This is so fascinating to me. Just personally, take a look at source 21. Flipping the page, I'm jumping a little ahead here, but in Shmuel Aleph Perek Tes Vav, which we learned last year, when we learned about the sin of Shaul HaMelech, where he does not kill the king of Agag, the operative word, the word of misguided passion, is the same word. Take a look, source 21. Atol lacha leich. He says to Shaul, "Don't have misguided compassion on them." More than that, 22. What does he do? He has misguided compassion when he shouldn't have had. On what, by the way? On people and tzon, right? The flocks that shouldn't be lost on us, right? There's the parable, sheep is right here again. And finally in source 23, they had chemla on the flocks. Here we have the same thing. Here we have the flocks. And here is the misguided passion, which David HaMelech is rectifying. Is that fascinating? It's almost like Tanakh is trying to say, you know, press here and compare this back to Shmuel Aleph Perek Tes Vav and understand the differences. And that's going to be a question that's going to be burning in the background, because Shaul HaMelech sinned, and that was it. The carpet was pulled, and he was not standing anymore. But David HaMelech sins, and we're going to see that David HaMelech is going to suffer unbelievably because of this, but he's still going to be standing. So we're going to have to compare this, and Tanakh seems to be underscoring that point. Sorry, Michelle. That was exactly your point. Okay, excellent. Great, Shelley.
So the only difference you see is that one is Chamol Le, and the other is Chamol Kav.
Yes, okay, good.
There's a difference, obviously.
Correct. Very good, very good, very good. And I think that might be perhaps exactly the point is misguided passion versus correct passion. He had the wrong feelings of mercy, and this is not. By the way, the Malbim has a whole essay over there in Perek Tzvav of Shmuel Aleph, where he talks about the different verbs and how the word lerachem is different to the word chemla. Rachem is in response to a direct need, as chemla is sort of graciousness, is above and beyond. And so this is not the place for extra feelings. Right? That was and so the Malbim goes on to that description of what chemla actually means. Fascinating. Yes.
It's interesting because when we say Modani every day, that's what we say.
Chemla Rabba. Very good. And meaning on Hashem's side, that's the grace of being alive every day. Right, so it's when correct, it's the most beautiful thing. When incorrect, it allows the space for very dangerous things to exist. It allows for very dangerous actions, because you can imagine afterwards, that's before we even get to the Nimshal, you can imagine this rich man explaining this to his friends at the bar that night, and he said, "I had this fellow come over, and I wanted, and I just didn't want to sacrifice, you know, the fine." My fine bovine, you know, my poor sheep, my poor cows, and you know, and sort of, you know, explaining, and he thinks of himself as a champion at whose expense, right? So that's what seems to be happening over here. Now let's dig a little bit deeper. So obviously, the parallels seem to be pretty clear. David HaMelech is obviously the rich man taking something from somebody else, which is dear to that person, which is singular to that person, as opposed to David HaMelech, and the gross lack of sensitivity. But still, we have to imagine that this whole story is trying to elicit more. There's going to be more messaging than just meets the eye. It's not just simply a one-to-one story. So the first thing, which is worthwhile noting, is as the Matsuras points out, but not to see inside, but that is that most court cases or dealings, let's say mediations between human beings, are grey. I've rarely ever seen a case which is black and white. I've rarely ever seen a person who's 100% right and another person who's 100% wrong, except when it relates to myself. But other than that, it's never the case. It's usually grey, which is interesting. Which means to say that mediation, or perhaps any form of arbitration, it becomes very difficult, because you have to really put a pin into the spectrum of grace somewhere. And people can get very upset, because a mediation always requires compromise on both sides, because somebody is losing out something at the cost of somebody else. That's how peace is made. So what's interesting is that what happens with us? So we get up to Shemayim. And we're gonna present our case, and we're gonna explain all the snafus along the way, right? And we're gonna explain to the Almighty, the Ribbono Shel Olam, that, you know, we were in the right a lot of the times that we did things, said things, whatever else it is. But like, what about the gray cases, right? So which is gonna be a lot of them, where there's a lot of different factors. There's environment, and there's pressure, and there's, you know, that it was a bad day. All the things that we can. So who sets like the tone for those kind of judgments? So the Gemara tells us, Rosh Hashanah, that we do. Meaning to say that the way that we generally look at other people is the kind of the fine-tuning of the equipment as it's going to be used for us. So should we be the kind of people who usually shoot from the hip whenever we hear something? Well, if it's going to be like that when we get up there, and that's the tone we've set for judgment, then that's how it's going to work for us. And if we're a little more relaxed, and we give people more space, and we don't get so highly strung about things all the time, Then when there's a little more space for grayness and it moves a little more to the white, then it's, you know, that we'll also have that space. And this is another example of this, where what seems to be happening over here is David HaMelech is actually put in the driving seat of his own court case without realizing it. Right? That's what the Mitzvah David is pointing out, is that it's not a simple confrontation, because in a simple confrontation, then David HaMelech will be obviously in the dock and he'll have to admit guilt. Yes, witnesses, and there's everybody against him. But it's worse than that. It's because he's actually tuning the equipment. He's actually showing the degree of culpability based on his own decision making. That's a very shocking idea. So that's the most basic idea which the Mitzvot David introduces to you, and it's terrifying in the sense that we're all going to be there somewhere.
Rosh Hashanah, what's
it say? Chamol Masecha. Right. There's the Chemla as well, which we hope we had as well. It is interesting that this is the famous idea which is connected to this is by Yosef. There's a famous midrash, it's quoted in the Gemara as well, that says that when Yosef comes to the brothers, he says, Ani Yosef ha'od avichai. The Gemara says, Oy lanu liyom adin, oy lanu liyom atochacha. Woe to us on the day of judgment, woe to us on the day of rebuke. But the Yosef story wasn't about, he wasn't really rebuking them, he was just, ta-da, I'm here, right? Now they must have felt bad, but he wasn't rebuking them, right? They could have felt guilty, they could have felt regret, they could have felt all kinds of feelings, but he wasn't necessarily rebuking them. So the Brisker Rav has a very, very famous idea, sorry, the Beis Halevi, one generation up, has a very, very famous idea, and he says the following, very brilliant insight. He says that, look, here come the brothers, and they have this whole business, and they say to Yosef, how could you, you cruel viceroy, you're separating a family, our poor father, he's elderly, he needs the son, the whole business, and now you're taking him, and he's, whatever, he was framed, it was a misunderstanding, the cup, the sack, the whole business, and Yehuda makes this whole plea. So what does Yosef do? He just says, it's me, is my father still alive? Meaning, you just said your father can't survive the loss of a child from his special wife, Rachel. Well, what were you thinking 22 years ago when you did the same thing? Which means to say, everything they said fell apart because of what they just said. Right? It means to say their own logic disintegrated under their own logic. That's a very terrifying thought. Right? So what the Mesudas David is saying is, David Melech's own logic is disintegrating under his own logic. Right? Meaning David HaMelech says, this man is deserving of death, but David HaMelech, you're standing over the pit. Right? You're it. That's the scene starting out, which is a terrifying idea. So this is, number one, is that it's not just being brought to court. It's making the judgment. But we can dig a little deeper as well. If you notice, this is so fascinating. There's one really unnecessary detail in the story. What is the unnecessary detail in this whole story here?
That a traveler came.
Why do we need a traveler? Right. Let's say the rich man needs supper. Right. Finished. Right? Do you ever notice that? Why do we need the guest? Right? That's all very nice, but let's pare it down to a more, you know, simple case. He wants supper one night, he doesn't want to eat Betsy, he goes over, and he goes and takes the friend, rather to his friend's lamb. That's it. Right, so why do we need the guests? But if you look at the verbiage, the Gemara actually comments on this. The Gemara says a very, very fascinating insight in Source 16. This is the Gemara in Nunbeis in Sukkah. The Gemara is discussing in general the struggles we have inside of ourselves, the struggles with our own indulgences. The Gemara says the following. Amar Rava would say, the great sage, the Amar Rava would say, Bitzchila karo'u holach, ulevasoich karo'u oreach, ulevasoich karo'u ish. You'll notice that this individual has got different descriptions. At the beginning he's called a walker, in the middle he's called a guest, and at the end he's called a man. Did you notice that? That there was a shifting description of this visitor, of this mysterious visitor to the rich person. Do you see that in the Pesukim? There's been a shift of description, the Gemara describes. Why? Shenemar, Vayavoha Helech, Leish Ha'ashir, Vayachmo Lokachas Mitzvona Mibkor Lasos Lo'oreach, Uksivaykach Kirsas Ha'ish, Harash Vayaseh Leish Ha'bo'alav. Which means, this is the brilliance of this. The guest is not an external reality. The guest is himself. It's brilliant. That means to say, who is he struggling with? He's struggling with himself. And what happens is it starts with holach. There's a fleeting thought. It says, you know, wouldn't it be nice if? And then the thought settles down in the corner and pulls up a chair and takes a drink from the refrigerator and it becomes a guest. And the thought starts settling down. Now, you know, I thought about it for a few days, but it wouldn't be so bad, you know, really. He doesn't need his lamb that much. And a few days later, after the thought festers a little more, it's no longer the passerby, and it's no longer the guest, it's the co-owner of the house. He's on the mortgage, right? So what happens is the Gemara is describing how we fall prey to thoughts. That's how it works. And that's what's happening over here. So Nasan Navi is explaining exactly the mechanics of the problem over here in the description of this visitor, who isn't really a visitor. It's himself. Yes.
David is a very smart man.
Yes.
He's coming with such a story. How is it that he's not...
You're right, Yeah. Exactly.
I mean...
You're right, Dina, you're right. You're right. It's so hard, but at the same time, what do you suggest?
First of all, I think.
think that he's trying to complicate the story by this
eating? Yep, yep, could be as well. That could be part of the...
This is one thing. And the other thing, I think that a person has to get out of himself to look at...
Yes, precisely. Completely agreed. That's the only way to do it. Meaning to say, we are so not aware of ourselves that unless we're dealing with somebody else, we will never be able to see it. And that's perhaps before the Mitzvot David, before the Gemara. Why do we need the story? Because that's the only way we're ever able to see ourselves. It's such a thing. I see this all the time. Yes, Leslie.
I think, as the Gemara points out, that the terrible part of it is like the veil of dignity associated with it, right? Like, David tried to do things under this veil of dignity. I'm going to bring back this guy from war. How he did it within the context of being a king. Just like under the veil of dignity of this traveler, like, oh, I'm just doing it to feed a traveler. I mean, come on. I mean, we have to feed him. And that's almost what makes it worse.
Yes, exactly. So it's interesting that the emotions and the self-deception seem to play a big role in the story itself, which is perhaps exactly the point. And by the way, coming back to that parallel with Shaul HaMelech, that was precisely the point as well. The self-deception which Shaul HaMelech went through. Although we'll see that the veil falls fast over here as opposed to there. One last thought. Now, Barbara Nell introduces it. You see, we may have heard the story many times, but there's so much depth to it. And I'm personally just learning through this. It's just remarkable. Here we go. One last detail. There's one incongruency between the story and the actual real life occurrence. What is the incongruency? It's one non-matching item. Let's forget our guest for a moment. Let's just forget the basic story. What is that incongruency?
I think it's a desire. And here,
I still, the desire could still be the fueling engine over here. We don't know. The vayachmol is to cover that. So it's still possible. But there's one base. You're getting to psychology. We don't need to get there.
Killing.
Do you see us? David HaMelech didn't just take the lamb. He killed the shepherd. Do you notice that?
Yes.
In this story, the rich person did not murder the owner of the lamb.
He just took the lamb.
What was that?
Okay.
Yeah. So it might be that there was room for that. Yes, you're right. And there's a large argument as to maybe how Uriah was in fact reneging on his responsibilities to the king. So maybe that's why it's left out. But Abarbanel says a very simple thing. Abarbanel says, is when Nasan HaNavi is going to implicate David, he's going to implicate him even worse than the case that he's bringing to bear. Meaning, David HaMelech immediately shouts out, let this person die. Die for what? For this heinous act of just taking the lamb. David HaMelech, you didn't just take the lamb.
Right.
Do you see that? That's what Nasan HaNavi is doing to him. Do you see that? That's what Abarbanel argues. He's putting him into such deep water. There's no way out. There's no way out once you get there. Shocking, right? That's how far it goes. That's Abarbanel source 17. We're not going to read it right now, but just again paying attention to the details. There's so much here. Let's dive a little further. One last question. This whole business about the four for the lamb. Why is David HaMelech says he should die? And then he says you should pay four for the lamb. Why four for the lamb? Like, where's that number come from? What was that? Good. So this is actually the case that was mentioned in Parshas Mishpatim just a few days ago. The Jewish legal aspects of damages. And at the end of Perek Chof Aleph in Shmos, this is source 19, it says the following. This is in our sources on 19 over here. He says, Ki yignov ish shor oseh. Let's say a person steals a sheep or a ox or a lamb and shechts it and sells it. So as opposed to a regular case, if I steal a regular item, right, I walk out of your house with a grand piano, what happens? Then I have to pay double. That's the regular case. Is what's called kefil. It's a penalty to push people away from stealing, right? But the exception is if you actually shecht the animal. In that case, chamisha bakar yishalem tachas ashor, va'arbat son tachas aser. In that case, you pay five times the value of the ox and four times the value of the sheep. What is David HaMelech doing? He is simply applying Torah law to this case. Here is a person who took somebody else's lamb, sheep, and shechted it. Right? So ultimately, this is exactly the principle talked about in Parashas Mishpatim, which David HaMelech is applying. So it could be a basic law. But the Gemara in Yuma, as quoted by Rashi and all the Mephoshim, say, no, much worse than this, much darker. So it could be, yes, David HaMelech was saying that, but David HaMelech didn't realize what he was really saying. And what he's really saying is the next six prokim in Sefer Shmuel Beis. Take a look at Rashi. Rashi quoted in Source 20, Yishalem arba atayim, kach irilai. This is what's going to happen to David HaMelech. Shiloka ba'arba abonim, hayeled, va'amnon, va'tamar, va'avshalom. Oh boy, he's going to suffer. It's going to be terrible. And in fact, there's going to be four children that he's going to be embroiled with that he's going to lose. It's going to be so painful to David HaMelech. And based on what? David's own verdict. That's what just happened. Meaning that David HaMelech, yes, he was applying the regular law. But that law reflected right back on him. Very, very scary thought over here. So there seems to be two dimensions of what's happening. It's David HaMelech's natural legal application and the reflection.
Why did David say that he was Ben Mavet? He really wasn't. If he stole the sheep, he really
stole it. Yeah, so there's an interesting question generally, and that is that one of the great commentators from the medieval age, Rabbeinu Nissim, is known as the Run, has an essay called In Drashas Run Yud Aleph, in the 11th essay. And we assume from the fact that the book's called Drashas Run, these are the things he would give on Shabbos. But oh boy. These were not 9-minute or 12-minute drushes. So they're long essays, and he talks about the legal system. And Parashat Shoftim, Drash Yudalf, he talks about the legal system. And one of the things he points out that court, let's say a Jewish based in, has certain parameters. So for instance, a court can only put a person to death if they have very, very specific limited circumstances. There's two witnesses, there's warning which is given explicitly within a very short span of the action which is committed. The person acknowledges and still goes on to commit it. So you say to a person, don't break Shabbos because it's on pain of death. And the person says, I know, but, and they do it. And there's a very, very limited window in order to actually bring a person to death. But the question that the Drash Hazaran says, well, how does that work then? How does society run? Because basically, I'll always find a loophole. I'll always find some sort of detail that I can get out on. So what's going to stop me from just being, you know, a terrible human being? So he says, well, that's why we have the parallel arm of justice, which is called the king. And the king can kill based on circumstantial evidence or rectifying society. So here's an example of where the king is using his right. If you can have somebody who is so egregious, so terrible, so self-centered, right, and can live such a life, then yes. And so yes, he has that legal right, right, which is why the king has so many checks and balances as to their power, because they have such consequences to their actions.
Is Ben Mavet really a sentence?
Could be. We don't know. Could be.
Just an expression. Because after this, it really bothered me that after this he said that first he condemned him to die, and then he said, and he has to pay four times.
Yeah, that's his estate.
To die.
No, Dina, that's the estate, you know? The estate.
I understand.
Believe me.
I understand.
I hear you, but at the same time, you know, it will seem from the reflection of Nasan HaNavi when he explicates all these issues, it sounds like he meant it, because David HaMelech is going to have to beg to waive that. So it sounds like it's real. And yes, unfortunately, there are many people who die with penalties. You know, and they've got their estates have to pay up, and an inheritance is terrible. So anyway, so that seems to be what's going on over here. Now, the reflection. So this is now the David HaMelech has issued his verdict. Now we actually see what happens. So let's delve straight into this. Next section over here, which is I think the last one we'll do right now, and that is the application of the story. This is from Pasuk Zion to Pasuk Tess. And these are perhaps the two most heavy words in this whole section is Atah Ha'ish. You're him. You're the man. So says Hashem, the God of Israel. I made you king. I saved you. I allowed you the house of your master, the wives of your master. And I gave you the joint kingdoms of north and south. And if it wouldn't be for this, I'd give you more. Right? You killed, by the way, it seems to be repeated here. that you killed Uriah either yourself or through the Ammonite, the Ammoni, and you took his wife for your wife. So here, he goes straight for the kill. Nelson gives the exact reflection. We can't even begin to imagine what David HaMelech must be feeling at this point in time. The sheer shock, the sheer pain, the sheer fear, the regret, all the feelings which must be coursing through him the moment he hears those two words, Atah HaEsh. And it's a very heavy statement. The interesting word that I think is interested in focusing on is the word Bazisa, which meaning to say, it seems like part of the indictment isn't just the actions he did, but the fact that, how would you translate the word Bizayon? Bizayon is humiliating, disgracing, right? An act of disgust. So it was, what you did was an act of disgust to the name of Hashem. So there seems to be a little to this. What the Mitzvot points out is, if you take a quick look in the Mefarshim packet, on source 26, he says something very simple, and that is, he says, here we are. Sorry, it's 24. But Bizetani, which is actually the next section, Lischalel Shem Shomayim Al Yodcha, so that the name of heaven was Lischalel. How do you actually translate the word Lischalel? Means we translate Chilal Hashem. We talk about this notion called Chilal Hashem, defiling the name of Hashem. The word Chalal actually means just vacuum, empty. You empty the name of God, so to speak. God's presence is supposed to be in this world, and by certain actions, and we as representative ambassadors of the Almighty, have emptied this space. There's a vacuum now from godliness because of the way we've acted. That's what a Chil Hashem is. So you have done that, which is interesting, because if you think about this for just a moment, you know there was a debate between the Abarbanel and the Malbim, and it goes through the Marikra and the Radak, all the way through the Mefarshim, coursing their way through history as to, you know, whether David HaMelech was technically in violation of adultery or not, right? But even according to the Malbim, like let's even go to the Malbim side, that there was no technicality, that Uriah had divorced his wife already, the whole business, right? But what seems to be over here, and this is what the Malbim emphasizes right here, is that you're still Mechal El Shomim Shomayim, meaning all the technical details in the world, you're technically right, but you're egregiously wrong. That seems to be the point over here. And this actually plays more into the Malbim over here, because then the indictment isn't so much about, you know, critical, you know, law, you know, 103B in the accepted law of the country. It may technically be a loophole in 103B footnote 3, but you still, the way you acted was a disgrace. That seems to be the way the Mitzvot seems to be going. It's just a really interesting idea, Esther.
Yeah, it's interesting also that the whole impact of it is Atah HaEsh, and with Yosef, it's also only two words, Ani Yosef.
Yes.
So it's like very interesting that it is. It's so few words and it's such a big impact.
I think so. I wonder if we compare, just going back for a moment to the Yosef story, all Yosef needed to do was issue two words and everything reshaped itself. Mm-hmm. And I think that in our lives, ultimately, if you want to do the comparison, Lahavdil, exactly, ultimately, there's going to come a time at the end, where Hashem will say, "Ani Hashem, I was there," and everything else will also reshape itself. Meaning to say, in those times where you thought that you needed to be the champion and, you know, give people kapora or sort things out and do things because the ends justified the means, Hashem will say, "I was there." But I feel like the same two words will sort of will sort of reshape everything, and we'll have to rethink our rationales. So completely on the same page. There is an interesting insight here, which is given by the Chida over here, and this is a really very thoughtful idea. It's quoted in Chazal. The Radak quotes this as well, but he has a very fascinating way of putting it. Let's take a quick look at this Chida. Chida, of course, is Rav Azulai, who is a deeply Kabbalistic person. Also wrote many Sifrei Halacha. One of the Sephardi greats of the past generations, and he writes on everything. And in his Pirush on Tanakh, called the Chumash Tanakh, he says the following. Fascinating. He listened to 25. Here he says, Pirush HaRav Zera Birech. So this is, he's quoting the Zera Birech, Chelek Gimel, Al Brachos, Dav Chav Dalet, Amud Gimel. Amud Gimel, by the way, Amud means a column, Gimel means three, which means that the way his book was arranged was that there were four columns on the page. So when you talk about Amud Gimel, usually an Amud means each side of the page. when you have an Amud Gimel, there's obviously no third side to the page, right? We don't live in those dimensions. But it means a third column, which is over. Okay? Just even, he's trying to locate the reference over here. He says, V'zel shonai, uve'emes, he says, V'gufa inyan lo'chata David ha'melech olav ha'shalom v'chuloi. So he goes with the approach of the Malbim, obviously much before the Malbim, that David Melech, in fact, technically didn't sin on the case of adultery itself. So he quotes a specific idea. We're not going to get into right now. Kabbalistic idea. But it says, specifically, you disgrace the word of Hashem. Shavarta al buza drachov. The word pasuk that we're focusing on right now, which is pasuk tes, that you rak bozisa, you only disgrace the word of Hashem. Medayek gam kain rak, meaning to say, what was it? You were mezalzel, you disgraced the word rak. Okay, what does that mean? And he says ki David HaMelech Olav HaShalom. That's the abbreviation. Chata beuria deloy dorish achin verakin kaamosa. He did not appreciate the drashas of achin verakim, where you have a word ach or rak, small words and sentences which can give meaning to something. What does that mean? He says ki David HaMelech Olav HaShalom tziva leuria leilech velishkav imishtoy veloy rotza machmas she'aron sheloy bimkomai. So what happens? Let's go back to that night that Uriah arrives back at the camp. He arrives back in Yerushalayim. David HaMelech says, go back to your house. Uriah disobeys him. He says, but David Savar Shu Mored B'Malchus. David HaMelech felt that by disobeying me as the king, you're disobeying the central authority. That's considered rebellion, which warranted Uriah's death, ultimately. Uvemes Ksiv Rak Chutz L'Davar Aveira. So that when the Torah expresses itself saying that a person has to listen to everything the king says, it says, Rak, you should but listen to the king. Which means that there's exceptions, there's times where you can disobey the king. What's that Rak mean? What was that word Rak used to exclude? He says, Rak chutz l'davar aveira, ein sorech lishmo al ha-melech. That means to say that, let's say you have two values in tension. The king's telling you to do something, one value is to listen to the king. And the other value intention is, he's telling you to do something inappropriate. So what should you do in that case? So Uriah knew something was fishy, and he felt that there was a limitation to the king's absolute power. Therefore, I'm not going to listen to the king in this case because it's not right. It's not appropriate. That's how Uriah did it. Therefore, in Uriah's mind, was Uriah really rebelling against the king? No, because there's actually a disclaimer on obedience to the king, which is rak, only in certain cases. Which means, what is the word play here? It's very fascinating. There's always a deeper level of reading Tanakh. And that is David HaMelech, you excluded the possibility that Uriah was acting in good faith and had the legal license to disobey you by not going back to his home that night. You used that as reason that he was liable for execution. But rak bozisa, you excluded that drasha which he had the grounds to stand on. That's what the Chiddush suggests. Very fascinating. It's not what we'll call it a overarching theme, but it seems to be a very specific legal standing that Uriah had, which will undermine your standing, David HaMelech. Very fascinating way of looking at this. This is a different perspective on things. Okay, so let's see. I wanted to see if we have space for more right now. Because if we go into the punishment, I just want to see how much space this is. You know what? I think rather than jumping and rushing, let's hold here discussions, questions, and then next week we'll get into the actual punishment, which means it out, and how David HaMelech negotiates those punishments, because they're not going to all come out. Yeah.